Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover.
I'm joined now by an Irish woman who began her legal career in Dublin, but who in recent years has become one of the most successful lawyers in the United Kingdom, acting in many of the leading human rights cases there, including acting for bereaved families and survivors of the London bombings and the Hillsborough disaster. Keelan Gallagher, QC, is a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers, and she joins me now. Good morning, Keelan.
Good morning, Miriam.
I've watched your career for many years. It's so impressive. We'll chat about some of those landmark cases you've been involved in a few moments. But first, tell me about growing up in Portmarnock. And was the legal profession something you were always interested in?
Well, I grew up in Portmarnock in the 70s and 80s, a time when Portmarnock was probably mainly known for golf, pirate radio station Sunshine 101 and Tamango's nightclub, yeah, where the gang still goes. But myself and my brother grew up there in a house jammed full of books and with parents who really taught us we could do anything. And we were encouraged by them to think there's no limits to what we could do. And I think it's a testament to my parents, really, that we've turned out very differently. We're both based in London, but my brother's an investment banker and I'm a human rights lawyer. My father often says he's raised a left-wing daughter and a right-wing son. Yeah, but I think, Miriam, in some ways, it probably won't surprise anyone who knew me in childhood in those days to see me arguing for a living now. You know, I always liked words and writing and reading and in secondary school debating and kind of standing up for principles. Many long-suffering teachers in primary and secondary school could attest to that. But really, I came to law not because I wanted to be a lawyer. It sounds very cheesy, but I decided I wanted to do something that makes a difference. And then law was a way to do that. You know, and I remember when I was very young reading Judith Kerr's book, When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, and being outraged and feeling I needed to do something to fight injustice. So I came to law as a means to fight injustice and do something meaningful rather than deciding I want to be a lawyer and then human rights law following from that, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And were there lawyers in your family, Keelan?
Well, not in my direct family. I've got a family which, as many Irish families have, you'd probably call them preachers and teachers. So many generations of Vincentian priests, Sisters of Mercy nuns, primary school teachers. My mother was a nurse, a midwife, and then she retrained, became a primary school teacher working in Darndale. So I certainly had a sense of social justice from her. And my father was a civil servant and in his spare time a bookworm and a numismatist, a coin expert. So no law involved. Mm-hmm. But I did have two relatives who were lawyers. So, you know, I'm not someone who, like many of the people I now see who are very talented coming up through the ranks, who've had no exposure to law whatsoever. My uncle Sean, also a Northside Dubliner from Glasnevin, my father's much younger brother, was a solicitor, very influential person in my life. Didn't want to work in a large firm, which he used to call a legal factory, and ran his own firm in Dublin. And he was very committed to his clients and holding to account those who were putting them through the ringer, as he saw it. So although it was quite a different type of law, it definitely was influential on me. And actually, Sean, my uncle, was working until very recently, until his untimely death from COVID earlier on in the pandemic. And the other person is my aunt Inga is a barrister in family law, Inga Clisman. So growing up, she was always impossibly glamorous and deeply committed to her clients. So I did have two role models who did very different types of law, but who I could see being deeply committed to their craft and doing work which made a real difference.
So interesting. And I know you did the BCL, you did your law degree in UCD, and then you began your legal career here in Dublin, did you, Keelan? I mean, tell me about your early career, the areas you worked in, and then when you thought about going to London and why.
Yeah. So, yeah, I did my law degree in UCD in the 1990s. So we're fellow UCD graduates, Miriam. To be honest, I probably spent a fairly large amount of my time in the student bar and in the Literary and Historical Society rather than just in law lectures. But that is where I started. And then once I graduated, I taught at the law schools in UCD and in Trinity while I was doing my barrister training at King's Inns. And during that time, I started doing legal research and writing and activism on a range of human rights issues. So prisoners' rights to vote, the rights of adopted people to know their origins and to access their records. And I was gradually forming the view that really human rights, civil liberties was for me during that time when I was in Dublin.
And was that why you went to London? Did you feel, Keelan, that maybe the kind of cases you really wanted to work in might not come across your desk here in Dublin?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these situations where you don't always have a road to Damascus moment where you make a particular decision at a particular time. It was a gradual decision, really. After I'd finished in the King's Inns, I decided I wanted to take a year to focus on human rights issues and do postgraduate studies. So I came to Cambridge, so quite a different place to where I'd grown up and indeed to UCD. So I came to do a year just to kind of focus on that. So instead of going to the law library as I'd intended that year, I delayed it while I came to Cambridge. Initially came for a year. It's like a chant of so many people who are Irish in Britain. You come for a year and then 20 years later, here you are. But actually, during that time, I really formed the view that the work I wanted to focus on and do, I thought London was a good base for it. I thought about Strasbourg as well, or Geneva and other places. And actually, it's one of those funny things about how life happens. While I was at UCD, a book had been very influential on me, another book, Baroness Helena Kennedy's book, who's now my colleague and actually a very good friend at Doughty Street Chambers. She's one of those people who had a huge influence on me without knowing about it. I probably sound like rather stalker-like saying this, but Eve Was Framed was one of those life-changing books I read as an undergraduate student, and it made me think differently about the world, what the law could and should do, how women are treated by the law. And I kind of gradually formed the view that maybe it might be worth me spending a bit of time working in London, develop my human rights expertise. So I started working at Liberty, actually, the human rights organisation in London, as a human rights lawyer, doing a lot of European Court of Human Rights cases and so on. And then I moved from there to the bar in London. But it was a series of small decisions which have resulted in 2 decades now being based in London rather than a grand plan.
And it's so interesting the way chambers work in London, Keelan. Like, it's so different to the way, say, the law works here. Was it hard to get into Doughty Chambers? Obviously, it's a very well-known and very impressive chambers. As you say, Helena Kennedy was in there.
Yeah, so I feel very lucky that I've ended up there, because so many of the people I was admiring from afar, whose work I loved, were based there. And you've got to pinch yourself then when you realise they're your colleagues. You know, so for years I saw people like Edward Fitzgerald QC, Keir Starmer QC, who's now known for other things, you know, fighting the death penalty around the world, you know, and their work as lawyers changing lives in such fundamental ways, you know, getting rid of the mandatory death penalty in a range of countries. So I applied thinking I hadn't a hope, to be honest. I still thank my lucky stars that they managed to accept me, and they're now my colleagues and I work there. But it's been quite interesting, just because over the 20 years when I've been here, so I've been in the UK since 2001, you know, I left at a time when Ireland was a different place, but I also left at a time when the UK was a very different place. And over 2 decades, I've seen the UK become a much more insular place than it was in 2001, and Ireland do quite the reverse. So it's been quite an interesting time to be here and to be a member of the Irish community in Britain.
You have, as I said, look, worked in so many high-profile cases in the UK, including representing the bereaved families and survivors of the London bombings. Can you tell me a little about that, Keelan?
Yeah, of course. So many of your listeners will remember that was the 7th of July 2005, when there were 4 simultaneous or almost simultaneous attacks that killed 52 people and injured more than 700. And it was a life-changing day. That week, in fact, the UK had just secured the Olympics for 2012. And I remember I was out with a group of Irish people that week, and I remember thinking it was the first time I felt like a Londoner. You know, I'm never going to feel British, despite having English children and an English husband, although my children would kill me for calling them English. They very much identify as Irish, but they're both, you know, so I feel like I'm an Irish person and I'm a Londoner. And that's the first week when I really felt like that. You know, I felt like a Londoner. And you could see that in the 52 people who were killed. It was such an international group of people, you know, many people who were just in London on business, who were in London as tourists, you know, people who were first or second generation immigrants and so on. And I had the privilege a number of years later of acting for many of those bereaved families and for many survivors, including, you know, Paralympian Martine Wright, who you might remember lost both her legs in the Aldgate explosion, and many rescuers, including an amazing woman, PC Liz Kenworthy, who actually saved Martine's life. And they were all part of the 7-7 Justice Campaign. And they, as a group, felt that it wasn't enough that they knew who'd actually committed the atrocity, so the names of the four bombers. They wanted to have answers about what had gone wrong. They wanted to know whether the deaths were preventable, should the security services have done more, and they wanted to know ultimately if the response from the emergency services was sufficient or if there were lessons that could be learned. And over the years acting for bereaved families, I always find, no matter what the circumstances, there's always three things that they tend to want. They want answers about what happened, they want accountability when something went wrong, and they want action, because they don't want any other bereaved family to go through what they've been through. So with that group, we had to fight to have the inquest. And then when we eventually had the inquest, we had 5 months of inquests where they got answers, they got accountability, and they got a very detailed report about what had gone wrong. Because there were people who did incredible things that day, from the emergency services, and just people who were off-duty police officers, and just members of the public who wanted to help. But there were things which went wrong. There were real questions for the authorities to answer about preventability and why more had not been done with Mohammed Sadiq Khan in particular. And there also were serious lessons to be learned about management of a complex incident. So, you know, just by way of one very small example, when emergency services arrived on a number of the scenes at the underground stations, because three of them were underground, they started treating the walking wounded on the outside, who were the people having asthma attacks and so on, and who were grazed, and they didn't actually go in to deal with the core of the disaster for quite some time. And there's a real question for a number of the bereaved families that I acted for about that delay. Mm-hmm. And because it was a delay which meant many of them have had injuries, which meant they bled out during that time. And actually, there has now been a real change in the way in which incidents like that are dealt with. You know, and I see it every day, and I now sit part time as a coroner. I see every day the lessons of 7/7 and from that inquest, having achieved action and real change. But the other thing to mention probably about 7/7 is it's the first time in this country, in the UK, that what are called pen portraits were used at an inquest. And I know they're now being used at the Stardust inquest as well in Dublin. And they're a very powerful thing. And the reason that my clients wanted to do that is that really the whole process was so dehumanising for various reasons. You know, their loved ones were unidentified for days. It was a very hot summer in 2005. There were some terrible issues about how the bodies were stored during that period. And people had a very gradual realisation that their loved one who was missing had in fact died. They often, the connection between the person who died and body 31 and the actual person took some time, or body 17. Mm-hmm. And it was so dehumanising. So we started the inquest by every single bereaved family being entitled to tell a story about the person who had been lost. You know, it was a way to show the human face of terrorism. And we subsequently did that in the Hillsborough inquest. And that now happens day in, day out across the country. But it's so important because the inquest process is such a horrific thing in any event. You're dealing with the worst day of your life. You're dealing with loss of a loved one. And you're often dealing in these cases with loss of a loved one which was potentially preventable or where things went wrong. And it's so important to start by making sure the person who's lost is at the heart of the process. And 7/7 inquests were the first time we did that in this country.
That's so great. And you mentioned Hillsborough there, of course. I know you acted, Keelan, on behalf of families and survivors of that disaster. What did that involve?
Yeah, so with Hillsborough, I've done a few different bits. And again, it's one of those pinch yourself moments, Miriam, because as a law student in UCD, you know, I obviously studied, you know, cases like the Tony Bland case, and Tony Bland's family are now some of my clients. There's two separate bits, really, to what I did. I acted in the inquests from 2014 to 2016, so they're the longest running jury trial that has ever taken place in the UK. But then I also acted in a series of civil claims about the families getting answers and accountability and holding the police to account for what went wrong. But really, Hillsborough involved, it's unthinkable in so many ways. And in many ways, what the Hillsborough families and survivors experienced is unparalleled, given the scale, depth and duration of the justice they endured. You know, they had 3 decades of public struggle and private anguish, and not only having lost their loved ones who just went to a football match and never came home, they also had the outrageous additional injustice of an attempt by public bodies to cover their tracks and perpetuation of a false narrative that the fans had been responsible in some way, the drunken fans had been responsible. Now, that lie has, after a long fight, been put to bed. But how outrageous that the families had to fight for three decades to do that. And actually, the civil claims we only just settled very recently in 2021 with an apology from the South Yorkshire Police and the West Midlands Police, accepting that there had been a deliberate attempt to tell a false narrative about what had happened on that day.
It must mean so much to you, Keelan, doesn't it, that like only 2021, as you say, you settle those civil actions, they got an apology, the families, that you get that apology for those families and see what it means to them and for them.
Yeah, I mean, with bereaved families, they don't all want the same thing. You know, so for some families, in some circumstances, an apology is hugely important. You know, for others, they want a head on a platter. You know, for others, they want to have answers. It really depends. But with all of the Hillsborough families and what united the 96 and then ultimately the 97th, because there's another death that's been attributed to Hillsborough very recently, they were united in wanting to have accountability for what had happened on the day, what was an accident waiting to happen, as we uncovered during the inquests. You know, what happened on 15th of April 1989 was entirely predictable, because there'd been a series of other incidents and there'd been warnings in the years beforehand about the difficulties in the West Terrace, which simply hadn't been acted upon for a range of reasons. But they also needed to unpack the decades of injustice that happened afterwards. I mentioned earlier that, you know, of course, what the Hillsborough families and survivors have experienced is in many ways unparalleled, given the circumstances. But much of what they've experienced is not exceptional. There's trends that I see a lot when bereaved families have a loved one that's died in the care of the state or the hands of the state. So, you know, some common themes. One I'd flag is demonising the dead. You know, the disgraceful and odious peddling of lies about what happened in the aftermath of the deaths to deflect blame is not specific to Hillsborough. You look at something like Jean-Charles de Menezes' death in 2005. Mm-hmm. You know, immediately lines were being put out describing him as a suspected terrorist, behaving suspiciously, wearing a heavy padded jacket and so on. And there was no truth to that, but this false narrative starts to circulate. So you get that, and you get institutional defensiveness. There are themes which we see in many cases involving state deaths, not only in the UK. You know, it's also something I've seen in my international work, you know, including many of the cases I do which involve the deaths of journalists. You get that institutional defensiveness, look over there, there's no problem here.
And I know recently you also worked with your colleague Amal Clooney, representing the Nobel Peace Prize winning journalist Maria Ressa. Tell me about her. And also, I have interviewed you before, Keelan, of course, about Daphne Caruana Galizia, who was, of course, assassinated in Malta in 2017.
Yeah. So a large part of my work is working for journalists who are targeted around the world because of their work, and also acting for bereaved families of journalists who've lost their lives simply for doing their jobs. So simply for being journalists. So those two cases you mentioned. So Maria Ressa, yes, myself and Amal lead the international legal team acting for Maria Ressa, who's an incredibly brave, brilliant woman. So she founded 10 years ago with colleagues Rappler, a media company for investigative journalism in the Philippines. And really, independent investigative journalism in the Philippines is an act of bravery. So we now know that at least 22 journalists have been killed since President Duterte assumed office in 2016. And simply for doing her job, Maria Ressa takes her life in her hands. Now, she's been convicted on baseless charges. She faces decades behind bars. She receives daily threats of violence and rape simply for doing her job, for being a journalist. And she faces over 100 years in prison for doing her job. Now, a number of months ago, we were delighted to see that the Nobel Committee awarded her and a Russian journalist, Dmitry Muratov, the Nobel Peace Prize. And it was awarded to both of them for their efforts to safeguard freedom of expression, which is a precondition for democracy and lasting peace, and for their courageous fight for freedom of expression in the Philippines and in Russia. And I was over in Oslo. I had the privilege of being over in Oslo with Maria for the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony, a very restricted ceremony compared to usual because of COVID. So far fewer people in the room than there would usually be, but an incredibly moving day. You know, she has chosen to return to the Philippines. I mean, many of the journalists I work with are in exile. They can't return to the countries they're from because of risk to their lives. And Maria's chosen, despite all those risks, to return. And the reason she does that really is that she thinks if she were to do anything else, she would be sending a message to young journalists that journalism is not safe in the Philippines. And she thinks it would shut down journalism in the Philippines. So she herself feels she's got to keep fighting. She's got to keep doing her job. And she often says to me that every time she's threatened, it just makes her more determined. It just tells her she's doing something right. So we're continuing to act for her. We've managed to get rid of two of the cases in the last year, but there's a number more cases still outstanding. And I should say, Ireland has just opened an embassy in Manila in the Philippines. So we'll be speaking to the Irish ambassador and his team in Manila about what the Irish can do to support Maria Ressa.
Listen, you've also worked on other cases with an Irish angle. Tell me about that case involving the Margaret Keane gravestone. I know it was very important to the Irish community in Britain, and it involved, wasn't it, using Irish. They wanted to use Irish in their mum's gravestone.
Yeah, that's right. So the Keane family, so Margaret Keane emigrated to England in the 1950s, like so many other Irish people. And she married an Irishman, and the family live in Coventry. And Margaret died in 2018, age 73. And her family wanted to put on the gravestone, "In our Gréige Jo," so "In our hearts forever." Which you would think is, you know, that's the way they wanted to honour her. She'd been huge in the GAA community, her and her husband. They also wanted to have a GAA, a cross with the GAA symbol on it. And for various reasons, it was necessary for the design of the gravestone to be approved by the ecclesiastical courts, the Church of England courts. And you would have thought it was quite straightforward, but in fact, there was a ruling which was so shocking to so many of the Irish in Britain when it came out. There was a ruling, and he rejected their application for the memorial stone using that phrase, "In our Gréige Jo," on the basis that the passions and feelings associated with the use of Irish Gaelic, I'm saying Irish Gaelic because that's what he said, could lead to people regarding it as some form of slogan or a political statement. So his view was that if people saw Irish on a gravestone, they would immediately jump to think this is some form of political symbol. And, you know, it's astonishing, really. So we ended up taking the case on for the family, and we fought it through the courts up to the Church of England's highest appeal court, the Court of Arches, of the Archbishop of Canterbury. First and only time, I think, I'll ever be in that court. It's very strange. You know, you've got to make your submissions with the sound of the bow bells in the background in a church. But the court agreed with the family and with us that actually the approach that had been taken by the Chancellor had been discriminatory and anti-Irish. And that is undoubtedly correct. And it's been a very important case for the Irish community in Britain, you know, who could just see in Margaret Keane and her family so many things which spoke to them. You know, I mentioned earlier my kids who are English and Irish. They certainly cheer for Ireland, not England, I've got to say, whenever they're playing against each other. And they very much identify as Irish rather than English. They've got very Irish names. I've cursed them with names that are difficult to spell and pronounce, with fathers and the works.
What are they?
So they're Shiva, Oisin and Dohi. Yeah, so every time someone says, "How do you pronounce that?" it reminds them where they come from. You know, they very much identify as Irish. They call themselves Irish. In fact, my daughter recently, in relation to football, was refusing to even consider supporting England against anyone else. She's in the anyone but England camp, which I think many of your listeners probably are too. And when my English husband asked her to explain why that was, she said, "Well, if I had to summarize it in one word, it would be history," which I thought was quite insightful. But, you know, I've got Irish children who have English accents, who are second generation and who very much identify as Irish and who live in the UK. And Margaret Keane's family, their Irishness was so is so hugely important to them. And it was so offensive for them to be told, "Your Irishness, your badge of identity, it is something a negative, you know, something to consider with concern." And it's such a nonsensical approach, you know, to think Irish is different to other languages, because the family did a huge amount of their own research in the graveyard, and they found that, in fact, there were other gravestones in Welsh and in other languages. There was one in Welsh which said in Welsh, "In our hearts forever," and that was apparently fine. So Irish had been singled out for special treatment as if it was a political language. And, you know, as many people said online at the time, you know, this is completely ridiculous. The suggestion that as soon as you see the Irish language, you assume it's some form of IRA Republican slogan is just so offensive. So it was a very important case to the Irish community in Britain and to the Keane family. And I'm glad to say the Keane family finally have been able to say their goodbye to their mother in the way that they wanted, with the words that they wanted, and with the gravestone that they wanted. And they should never have had to fight through the courts to get that.
Well, they were lucky to have you, Keelan, and congrats to you for winning that case and for working on so many other brilliant cases. You've a glittering career in London and we're all very proud of you. Thanks for chatting.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you very much and keep doing brilliant things. Keelan Gallagher, thanks for being my guest this morning.
Thanks very much, Miriam.
And that's all from us for today. Thanks so much for listening. My thanks and sound to Mark McGrath, to the producer, Cora Ennis. Until the next time, next Sunday, Slán.